This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. Program is homecrafted and was recorded on July 16th. An article in the Texas Observer last fall by Sophie Novak presents the results of research at Johns Hopkins. Among other findings, they report that prices in Texas in 2018, before insurance, were on average more than 6 times higher than what Medicare allowed. In Brownsville-Harlingen, it was almost a factor of 10. And nationwide, the 4 most expensive areas are all in the Texas Rio Grande Valley, which happens to be one of the poorest areas of the country. One member of the research team, Martin McCary, wrote a book on the matter titled The Price We Pay. With prices skyrocketing, uninsured patients are on the hook for astronomical bills with little recourse. Worse, some hospitals routinely sue patients for payment and even garnish wages. McCary offers 3 recommendations. First, that patients require transparency. When Americans demanded nutrition labels, government and industry responded. The same is needed in healthcare. Second, accountability is needed in hospitals and insurance, especially in the areas of drug pricing, insurance costs, ambulance pricing, and surprise billing. Third, patients need more fair and equitable billing systems. McCary recommends system standardization, noting that billing quality is medical quality, and financial toxicity is a medical complication. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Stacy Pogue from the organization Every Texan, formerly called Center for Public Policy Priorities. Every Texan envisions a Texas where people of all backgrounds can fulfill their potential and contribute to our community. We also have our regular guest, Jim Harrington, founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott is here too. Good evening, everyone, and welcome. Thanks for joining us, Stacy. Could you tell us a little about yourself and more about Every Texan?
Sure. I'm a senior policy analyst with Every Texan, and I've been there about 12 years working on healthcare. And Every Texan knows that opportunity isn't the same for everyone, that people in Texas are working hard to support their families, but too many can't access things they need to thrive, like affordable healthcare or quality education or good jobs. And so we work on improving public policy to improve opportunity for all, because we believe that social justice requires public policy.
Yeah. And God knows there's plenty of room for good public policy in this state. My understanding is you're one of the specialists there in health insurance. And, you know, given that we've got the largest uninsured population, both by numbers and percentages in the 50 states, I imagine your work's cut out for you.
Yeah, we never have a shortage of work to do on the healthcare team at Every Texan. So yeah, even pre-COVID, we had the highest uninsured rate and the highest uninsured population.
Yeah. And why is that? Everybody talks about the Texas economic miracle and people are moving here in droves. And, you know, are they surprised when they get here and find out that more of their neighbors are uninsured than where they came from?
Yeah, I imagine that's possible, right? Leaders work to make the state the best for business or best for other, you know, interests as opposed to the best state for people. So there's a lot of stuff happening in other states to put some focus on coverage that we just don't do here in the state. And we also have an economy that has a whole bunch of jobs that traditionally don't offer health insurance, right? Which is another reason we need to focus on having a means to get health insurance in Texas for low-wage workers that doesn't require their employer to offer them coverage.
Yeah. And geez, the percentages are just the worst for Latinos and Blacks. And for some reason, I guess they're worse for adults than children. So what do you make of all those categories, for example?
Yeah, well, so one reason kids fare way better on getting covered with health insurance is because we have a Medicaid program that kids are eligible for, right? Kids in low-income families can get Medicaid or CHIP, but their parents who live in the same household and have the same incomes, almost always they can't get Medicaid, right? So we've created a pathway for kids to get covered, and we haven't even let the parents of those children get covered. They're not eligible for Medicaid unless they're pregnant or have a disability. So we could do a lot more on making sure adults have access to coverage, again, when they're in low-wage jobs that don't offer it. And then for a long time, we've had huge disparities that are baked in throughout our healthcare system and every other system, right? That produce vast disparities in access to care and coverage for communities of color, particularly in Texas, for Hispanic Texans, are far more likely to be uninsured.
Yeah. And on top of all this, we had some ray of sunshine a few years ago with the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as it's popularly called. And now, in the next Supreme Court session, one of the leading cases will be Texas versus California. And so there's the state of Texas out front trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. What's that about?
Yeah, and so I think one thing that's little known about the Affordable Care Act is that everybody knows Texas dug its heels in and objected to and stood in the way of implementing and benefiting the Affordable Care Act at every turn. But some things just weren't optional. And so it turns out we've had historic gains in coverage in Texas, even though we're still dead last. We've really benefited. We've got, you know, give or take a million more people who have coverage. And we'd do far better if we actually just maximized the coverage under that program. But even digging our heels in, it's been great for Texas. And so what we know is if the Attorney General's lawsuit were to be successful, if opponents of the ACA could pull it down in the courts, 1.7 million Texans would lose their health coverage. People who have pre-existing conditions would lose the protections they have. People who don't remember the bad old days 10 years ago might have forgotten that, you know, insurance companies used to be able to and routinely turn people down if they had asthma, if they used to have cancer, if they've got diabetes, or charge them a lot more. And so that kind of discrimination would be legal once again if the ACA is overruled in court.
Yeah. And so here we are now in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic. We're surging at the moment, near as I can tell, although I guess the hospitalizations in Austin at least appear to be on a plateau for the moment. I mean, we'll keep our fingers crossed. But here we are in the midst of this pandemic. And one story that keeps coming up, and we actually did a whole show on with Paul Saldana a few weeks ago, is that the pandemic is especially bad for Latinos and Blacks. So is this a genetic thing, or is this because of the lack of insurance and the poor healthcare? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, what it looks like across all the research I've read, which is, you know, new stuff coming out every day, is that it's not that COVID can tell what race or ethnicity you are, and right? It's that our entire healthcare system and access to good jobs and education system, it's all built on structural racism, right? And so the same problems and disparities that exist in our underlying healthcare system really have been revealed and shown in a new light with COVID, where we have people who are Black particularly, but communities of color more broadly, have much higher fatality rates, have higher infection rates, are living in communities where there's less likely to be testing, are in the jobs where they are more likely to be laid off, or in jobs where they're more likely to not have health coverage to begin with and then get laid off. So, you know, COVID didn't create any of these disparities. It's just really magnified all of the existing inequities in all of our systems, including the healthcare system and access to coverage.
Jim, you were on that show. You know, have you talked to Paul lately? Has the Austin Latino Coalition made any gains, as far as you know? Or,
well, you know, it's still a source of discussion. I mean, this certainly reflects the economic strata in our society, because the people that are, there are health issues to start with, to be sure, you know, in terms of diet and diabetes that seems to occur in the Hispanic community with greater regularity. But the bigger problem is that everybody has to work and has to work in proximity with each other and are exposed to each other and live in smaller dwellings. Quite a few people, for example, live in apartment complexes.
Yeah.
You're going to have greater contact. There's no doubt about it. I have one family that I work with that the husband was sent home from construction twice because somebody in his work crew, his construction crew, tested positive. And that meant that that family then lost, not only were exposed potentially, but also lost a whole month of pay.
Yeah.
Which, when you're making minimum wage, is pretty significant chunk of your family income. So, but it does reflect the inequity, right? Totally. You know, that we're depending on poor, low-income people right now to support us while exposing them to greater danger than many of us are exposed to.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about employment here, and, you know, it just seems to me in the bigger picture, the bigger scheme of things, that one of the tragedies in the United States is that health insurance got tied to employment, you know, and that's going back well into the 20th century, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was primarily around World War II, the end of World War II, that happened. Stacy, do you see any effort to move away from that? I know we've talked about, you know, every once in a while people talk about single-payer plans. You hear that debated among the Democratic candidates for president. What's your take on that? Are we stuck with this for all time now, given that health insurance got tied to employment?
I think it is a big political challenge to separate those two, or at least moving beyond giving people a choice to choose between, you know, job-based insurance for the people who are lucky enough to get it, including me, right, and a choice of something else. So I think, you know, what I see in the polling is that everybody's mad at their insurance, but they're so afraid that something else is going to be worse, right? Some of the things that have changed kind of in the, maybe it's political or economic sphere even, is that, you know, if we shed jobs and they're gone for a long time in this recession, which, you know, it seems to be quite possible, you know, the biggest economic downturn since the Great Depression, if those jobs don't come back quickly, coverage losses could be huge. There's some employers that are furloughed workers now and are still paying their benefits. And there's some people who are paying for a COBRA now because they're hoping that they're only out of work for a month or two and their employer comes right back. But if that doesn't happen, you know, the system that worked most of the time for most of us might not function that well for lots of people anymore. And so there might be new pressure to make sure that if we don't switch out the systems entirely, that we have a very viable safety net for people who don't get job-based insurance that could include Medicaid, that could include the Affordable Care Act health insurance exchange, the health insurance marketplace. It could include an opt-in to Medicare. There's lots of different structures, including ones that exist today, but none of them perform well enough or easy enough to get into, right? That they function well to pick up the, you know, millions of Texans who are losing their jobs right now.
Yeah, we just had a little email exchange about that yesterday. I think it was a New York Times bulletin said, what, 5 million people, was that the figure I saw, had lost their insurance since the onset of the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. And that's 5 million that have both lost their job-based insurance and then become uninsured. There's some number that will join their spouse's plan or get into Medicaid or buy in the health insurance marketplace. But in Texas, what the Urban Institute tells us is that half of all people who lose their job-based insurance will end up uninsured. We face, in Texas, the longest odds of residents in any state of losing our job-based insurance and then getting any other coverage. So that's why in Texas, that same report said that about 700,000 Texans just in the last few months have become uninsured. And that means now 3 in 10 adults, excuse me, non-elderly adults, adults age 18 to 64, mm-hmm. 3 out of 10 of us are uninsured in Texas. Wow. So, you know, Texas at the state capitol needs to take coverage seriously, but Congress also, you know, they've passed several COVID packages and they are negotiating the next one, but in none of them has coverage been addressed, even though we're hemorrhaging jobs and with it, job-based insurance.
And it's staggering, you know, what happens to people, you know, so here we are, you know, dealing with this pandemic and people lose their insurance and then somebody gets sick. Do they go begging it at the hospital or they just stay home and in need of a ventilator and instead they just wind up suffocating to death at home? I mean, what happens to folks?
It's either of those kind of two eventualities. So we know from mountains of research that people who are uninsured are far less likely to seek care when they need it. They're more likely to delay it or skip it. They're less likely to have a regular source of care. So, you know, when they do get sick, they're not going into their primary care physician because they don't have one. They're going into an emergency room potentially. So being uninsured will mean people will suffer needlessly and not get healthcare when they need it. And then for others who do access the healthcare system, they are far more likely to get giant medical bills that they cannot afford. With insurance, we've got some predictable, although they're high, very high, deductibles or co-pays. But when you're uninsured, you get billed the full, you know, market rate generally, the full billed charge. And it's essentially impossible in a lot of cases for low-income people to pay those prices. And so they sometimes you'll see really aggressive collection efforts that are very harmful for low-income communities or people declaring bankruptcy because of medical bills. Or in other cases, you just see the healthcare system itself takes that loss and it hurts rural hospitals and it hurts hospitals everywhere that are struggling right now, keep their doors open. And it means, you know, we pay for that care through taxes, but it's not delivered in the way that any of us want. Any of us, you know, that none of us want to get our healthcare that way.
Well, you mentioned the rural hospitals. I don't have the statistics, maybe you do, but what I've heard recently in the past few years is that they're dropping like flies, that it's just one rural hospital after another is closing. What's the one out in the one that's gotten all the attention out in Sweetwater, for example? Why is that happening?
Rural hospitals are particularly challenged because they just don't have large volumes that urban hospitals have to keep their doors open and to keep revenue coming in. And there's some unique challenges too. The uninsured rates in, you know, everywhere in Texas, they're high, but rural counties actually have higher uninsured rates than urban counties. And so when hospitals in rural areas are more likely to have somebody come in who's uninsured, who's not going to pay that bill and not going to be able to pay that bill. And then they don't have a huge local taxpaying base, you know, taxpayers to pick that up and spread it across. So rural hospitals are particularly challenged. And but I believe this is a problem, not just in Texas, obviously, but that I think it was Texas had the largest number of rural hospitals that have closed in the last couple of years. And one thing rural hospitals have been advocating for right alongside of us is expanding Medicaid, one of the options we have under the Affordable Care Act, to make sure that adult Texans who are uninsured but in low-wage jobs, whether in poverty or near the poverty line, where they'd have an affordable healthcare option. I think it's only 13 states that haven't done it yet. Texas is one of those. That would really help rural hospitals, especially because the uninsured rates of adults are so much higher in those counties.
Well, and that was the big fight, I guess, over whether or not Texas would become part of ACA. It was all over Medicaid, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the state options. The health insurance marketplace, which a lot of people think of as Obamacare, isn't a state option. It's set up and run at the federal level, and Texans can buy into it with very generous subsidies for people who were just over the poverty line. Yeah. But there are no subsidies for people in poverty. It's weird. Most of our means-tested programs, you make $1 too much and you get kicked out, right? Even if you can't afford food or rent. But with healthcare, it's that you can make too little because we haven't expanded Medicaid. We've created this gap where people who are low wage and working full time and taking care of their kids have no way to get affordable healthcare, even though neighbors next door who make a little bit more can get good subsidies in the marketplace and good coverage.
And as I recall, I mean, that was back in Rick Perry's time. I think the argument was despite all the money that came with that, their objection was that eventually the state would have to pick that up. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the structure under the Affordable Care Act is that the first few years, starting in 2014, the federal government picked up the full amount of the cost, and it ticked down a little bit every year until it got to a final share of the federal government pays 90% and the state picks up 10%. Yeah. So even at the, you know, like the worst deal the state could get, the federal government pays 90% of all the costs in it. But now, since, you know, a number of states expanded back in 2014 and others, including deep red states who have voted, their citizens have voted for Medicaid expansion in states like Idaho and Oklahoma, right? We have a lot of research now from the states that have expanded Medicaid. And it turns out that what it says is states that have expanded Medicaid, it's not eating up a huge part of their state budget. It's not crowding out funding for education, that the savings to downstream savings to the state dollars you would invest in family planning, mental health, criminal justice, you name it, that, you know, that Medicaid expansion's a wash, if not an actual benefit for states, because it also generates a lot of new tax revenue from all the healthcare spending that comes with it. So those arguments, which, you know, they haven't played out, right? There's plenty of proof that states aren't struggling financially because of Medicaid expansion.
I mean, it almost sounds like Texas has just shot itself in the foot, you know?
I think that's a good way to say it. And, you know, we didn't know a pandemic was coming, but it's here now. And, you know, we've got 4 million people who rely on Medicaid, but more than that who are uninsured. Now, they wouldn't all qualify for Medicaid or nowhere near it, but Medicaid's one of the central foundational pieces of our healthcare system. And it is funded part of our big response to COVID, right? It's paying hospital bills. It's paying testing bills. It's keeping clinics open. And our Medicaid, you know, states that have expanded Medicaid are far ahead of Texas in their ability to use Medicaid as a tool to respond to COVID and help the public, help the residents of that state.
Yeah.
Is there any movement made at this point to try and get that back on some sort of ballot for us to re-vote on at this point? I would think that would be the logical thing to do.
Yeah, so the states, my understanding, and others jump in here, the states that have passed that by voting have an initiative or referendum abilities. They have tools in their state constitution that we don't, that let the public directly vote to pass policies. So the closest thing, my understanding is, we have here is a constitutional amendment. And there were bills introduced last legislative session to put this question to Texas voters as a constitutional amendment. The barrier is those have to pass the legislature first before we get to vote on them. So the efforts to let the people vote on Medicaid expansion through the channel we have available to us in Texas didn't work because the legislature stopped it. The legislature has not yet voted to expand Medicaid, but, you know, that they'll have another opportunity. And frankly, I think there's lots of experts that believe that there's enough authority within the governor's office right now to do it without waiting on the legislature. It's certainly possible that the governor could be doing that right now as part of a COVID response without waiting.
Good to know.
There was almost nothing done on the healthcare end of things, if I recall, in 2019. Is that right? Or did I overlook something?
No, I wish I could tell you overlooked something. It's both frustrating and heartbreaking. So obviously we didn't pass Medicaid expansion, which would have, you know, given some security in healthcare to 1.5 million uninsured adults in Texas. But even smaller things, like there was one bill that actually got out of the House but died in the Senate to let new moms get Medicaid, or half of all births or more are funded through Medicaid. And the new moms who have Medicaid for their birth, they get kicked off of Medicaid after 2 months. 2 months after they have their baby, that they lose their healthcare coverage. And that, of course, is one of our challenges in addressing maternal mortality, which also has a huge disparate impact on Black women. And so we supported a bill that would have let new moms stay on Medicaid for a year through a longer part of the postpartum period, when issues like diabetes, mental health issues, substance use issues, that when they come up later after giving birth, we could make sure those new moms got health care. And that didn't pass. And even what I thought was like the lowest hanging fruit, we have these, you know, administrative requirements, loopholes, barriers, red tape that make families jump through a bunch of hoops to keep their kids enrolled, eligible kids. We're kicking out thousands and thousands of eligible kids from Medicaid every month because of paperwork, because of red tape. And we could have just fixed that. And even that didn't pass. So the legislature missed its opportunity at every turn to make small and sweeping changes that would have mattered on healthcare, on health coverage, and they didn't do it.
Yeah. And then there's this whole matter of immigrants and how many undocumented parents, and in some cases, undocumented parents with U.S. citizen children, you know? I mean, what do undocumented people do for healthcare here in Texas?
Well, one thing we've been hearing from a lot in the last, well, couple of years now, from our partners at community clinics and partners who are providing healthcare to undocumented immigrants and mixed immigration families, is that the fear in the community, due to a whole bunch of changes, but particularly in healthcare, the public charge rules, where people were afraid, let me make sure I pull this out of the back of my mind, that they wouldn't be able to change their immigration status and get a green card. I hope I got that right. Jim can jump in if I got wrong.
If they ever took advantage of the system, yeah.
Right. Exactly. And there was so much misunderstanding and misleading information being given out that people were afraid even to get benefits that their U.S. citizen children were eligible for, much less the parents themselves, right? And so people were afraid to use healthcare benefits, to use healthcare clinics, and still are. So it's a very, healthcare is very complicated in mixed immigration status families because of the fear. And of course, the COVID response appears to be leaving out all of these families altogether. A lot, you know, the relief checks that many of us received weren't sent to families that contain undocumented immigrants. And so there's so much hardship and so much struggling right now in those families. And it's not just, of course, on the healthcare front.
Sure. And I'm just guessing that all those construction workers that are not documented, that healthcare is not part of the employment agreement with them.
That's my guess. I'd have to, you know, again, Texas has, you know, just a higher share of jobs in the sections of the economy that don't, that just historically haven't come with benefits. Construction's one of those service retail industries. And once your competitors in Texas don't offer health insurance with their jobs, you don't have to either, right? So there's lots of people who go to work every day in Texas, full-time, year-round, and don't have, and still can't get health insurance through the jobs that aren't offered insurance at their jobs. And that seems to be at least my takeaway working at, you know, at the Capitol and trying to convince people, is one of the biggest misconceptions is that if you work full time, you get health care, you get health coverage with your job. And that is just simply not true in a lot of low wage jobs and a lot of difficult jobs like construction.
We're speaking with Stacy Pogue from the organization Every Texan about healthcare and insurance in the state of Texas. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on July 16th. We're speaking with Stacy Pogue from the organization Every Texan about healthcare and insurance in the state of Texas. Let's continue. So coincident with COVID here, you know, in the last few months, we've seen some incredible protests in favor of Black Lives Matter. I think that's given a lot of us some hope. Is there any way that greater social change, health insurance for poor people, that that might enjoy some of the attention that the Black Lives Matter protests have brought about?
I think so, and I hope so. I mean, I think there's synergies across all of these things. It's not just that communities of color or Black Texans are face a disadvantage or disproportionate police violence. They are far less likely to have health coverage, right? So 3 in 4 Texans who are uninsured but could be covered under Medicaid expansion, they're Texans of color. right? And that's probably not a surprise to anybody who studies these issues, that, you know, the steps we need to take, we know exactly what they are, and it takes political will to do them, and it takes focusing on your communities and your neighbors to do them. But I think the protests and the education and the momentum, I think they align, because structural racism is at the root of disproportionate police violence and communities of color being far more susceptible and having higher fatality rates from COVID. They all tie back to the same root issues.
You know, we're talking a little bit about the 2019 legislative session, and we're not that far off from the next one, 2021. Tell us a little about your efforts during a legislative session. I mean, do you draw up legislation that could be adopted, or what will be your role in the next legislative session?
Yeah, so we do several things on that front. We do research on the extent of problems, what other states are doing, pulling data together to figure out what are the best policy solutions that, you know, address healthcare and close disparities, right? Or improve access to unemployment insurance in an equitable way. So we'll be doing all of that work now, but we'll pitch ideas to members of the legislature and write out the outlines for the bills and find champions to carry them and push policy solutions through the legislative process. And then, of course, we have other tools that we do, other strategies and tactics. Like, we are parts of lots of different healthcare coalitions, but of course, we don't just work in healthcare. That's just my little niche. But jobs, education, we work with allies and partners to share our data analysis, to share our budget analysis, and to help move good legislation forward. And then we'll lobby at the Capitol and show up and testify. And in the last couple of years, we've really tried to build out and increase the capacity of our online organizing and calls to action to get the public more engaged with pushing for some of this stuff. And actually, on that front, our healthcare work, we're part of a really, I think, neat campaign called Sick of It Texas, #SickofItTX, that's helping educate Texans about the need for Medicaid expansion and the need for coverage more broadly, and to unite the voices that are demanding that Texas take seriously the needs for healthcare coverage and focusing on that in the state.
What better time to make people aware that we're all in this together than a pandemic?
Yeah, I think it has not been more clear to me before that my health depends on the health of not just the people in my household and not just the people in my street or my office, but my whole community. And so, you know, it's probably a good time to be talking about health coverage for full communities.
Yeah. Well, we've got just a few minutes left here. Jim or Michelle, do you have some other questions or observations?
I think it's always important for us when we're looking at this stuff to reflect on the injustice that exists in our society that actually has become manifest and exacerbated by the pandemic. And I think it's important to do this as a way of talking about how do we make significant changes, maybe addressing pandemics or where we are economically, and that we don't want to be talking about going back to normal. So I'm saying that we always have to be dealing with this in a larger context. This is the time, this is the opportunity for us to take part in helping to educate the community. And I think we should be cognizant of that in our conversations with people.
I would also add that we need to realize it's a voting year and that the people that we're getting ready to elect into the next offices in November are going to have a big impact on what's going to be able to get done. Mm-hmm. So educate yourself as to who we're getting ready to choose from is best for moving these issues forward and getting us to where we want to be.
And I think too that we have to search out ways to do this. For example, probably most of us, a large number of us, participate in neighborhood listservs. I think this is a time to try to use that avenue, since we're doing a lot of social distancing that precludes leaving the house. You know, that every avenue that we can to work to raise these issues for people. And I think it's good to tell them in the context of individual vignettes, individual cases. So it's, for example, my brother-in-law, this is hypothetical. My brother-in-law has the virus. He's in the hospital. He can't pay to personalize this stuff so that people feel it and understand it. Because lots of times we're talking about this stuff, is it just continues to be, you know, the arguments that have been made. But I think when this stuff starts to hit home personally, is an opportunity to encourage people to be more participatory about this. And as Michelle says, also to look at this as an issue on which to vote.
You know, to your point, Jim, Naomi Klein wrote a book, a classic, about 15 years ago called The Shock Doctrine. And it was all about how groups have used disasters, whether natural or economic or whatever, to bring about societal changes. And, you know, I think what motivated the book was the 9/11 event and all of the policies, the U.S. policies, and entering into war after that and so forth. But it's a wonderful book. She goes back and talks about Chile and other historical arguments, you know.
All you need to do is look at FDR and the Depression. Sure. I mean, that was an enormous amount of social change that happened in the country. And to his credit, he took advantage of that situation and was able to mobilize people to support him.
Exactly.
And that's what we've got to be trying to do with what we're going through right now, because it's not just a question of our health, but it reflects the economic unjust structures that govern us.
Precisely. Well, Stacy, we're running out of time here. Do you have anything else you want to wrap this up with? Any thoughts that I skipped over here? Or?
No, I'll just add, if you guys are interested, that, you know, one of the things we're focused on now is in the next 2 weeks, the next COVID recovery package will come out of the Senate. The Senate Republicans are looking at putting that together now, and then they'll have to negotiate with the House. But, you know, we need substantial aid to our cities and states that has not come from Congress, including Medicaid funding, but not limited to, because our cities and states are encountering so many expenses related to COVID, and our schools are, that aren't being funded. And without federal aid, there will be, without substantial federal aid, new federal aid, there'll be huge cuts to programs that we care about and that support our communities, like Medicaid, like education. It's terrible to think at any time that our families and our neighbors are struggling to put food on the table or are struggling to pay rent, and that they have to choose between food and healthcare. But it's happening in more households now because of this downturn. But it's one of the things that we need to be talking to Congress about right now. We've got a really short window to let them know that federal aid, as well as many other things, is going to be vital to making sure that our cities and counties and schools and our state can provide the services they need to in this crisis.
Very well put.
Well, thanks for all your good work, Stacy, on this.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure talking with you here. Michelle, did I cut you off there?
No, I was just going to say thank you for joining us.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you.
It's been eye-opening for me as well. There's so much of this. It's complex, and yet ultimately this is determining who gets health care and who doesn't.
Agreed.
This is Friday, July 17th. Time to check in with our friend at the Austin Chronicle, staff writer Austin Sanders. How you doing, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on again, Bob. It's good to talk with you.
Yeah, it's been a few weeks. I understand that the city manager has issued his first draft of the city budget. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. On Monday, July 13th, he presented his proposed budget to a mayor and city council, which I should note a couple of things before. Typically, staff, the budget writers, start working on the budget in February. So, you know, pretty early on in the year, it takes a long time to put together. And so the things that people were looking for was, you know, how much funding is going to be taken away from the police department. That was a big interest. There's been a big push from activists and advocacy groups to reduce spending on policing.
I think some of those numbers have been as high as cutting it by $100 million, right? I mean, the total police budget's where somewhere around $440 million, and they're calling for a reduction of like $100 million. Is that right?
Yeah, so different groups are calling for different amounts. Austin Justice Coalition has said $100 million. Another group, which has advocated for years for police funding decreases, Communities of Color United, is saying over $200 million. So huge numbers, which is why what the city manager proposed was so disappointing. In effect, it's an $8 million reduction in a proposed budget for next year for the police department. Technically, it's $11 million, but $3 million of that is just going to be reinvested back into APD, although not for policing, really. It's to improve the department's records keeping and training materials and the way that new officers are trained. So there's a few different numbers to look at, although I'll also add that some of the cuts are really just from like these cost drivers that are built into every department's budget, like pay raises for employees and things like that. So when you do the math and cut away what that spending accounts for, it's really only like $150,000 reduction in what the department will have to operate with next year compared to this year. So really, that's all to say there's a huge gap between what budget proposes and what activists and the community have been calling for in terms of decreasing funding for the police department.
So I wonder what his strategy is. I mean, is he basically going out there with the essentially the same budget as last year and then telling city council, you know, you got to direct me here. You've got to make these cuts. I'm not going to do it.
Well, there's a couple of things. Like I said, for one, you know, the budgets process starts in February, and by June, when council introduced June 11th, when they passed these four public safety resolutions that in part provided direction on how to adjust police department spending, that's really too late to make substantive progress on that kind of direction. At least that's what the staff will say. So that's a part of it. Another part of it is Spencer Cronk has this kind of multi-year view of the process of what the city is calling reimagining public safety. So it's this acknowledgement that the kind of transformative change that the community wants, the city sees doing that all in one budget, all in one year, as just unworkable, as impractical to really do that. So he intends to, he's putting together like a task force involving community members and city staff and police department officials, advisory committees, which are going to work over the next weeks and months to propose other ideas for reducing the police department's budget that could be adopted throughout the next year as budget amendments. So that's sort of the city manager's view of it. Of course, city council members, especially the four that have been most vocal, that'd be Mayor Pro Tem Delia Garza, Greg Kassar, Jimmy Flanagan, and Natasha Harper Madison, they've been the four that have really led the charge on reforming the police department. They're unlikely to be satisfied by this $8 million in cut. It's very likely that we'll see budget amendments brought by all of the council, but especially those four, that are aimed at reducing, or I guess increasing, that amount that's cut from the budget from $8 million to closer to that $100 million figure.
Interesting. I want to talk about the process, but let's talk about one other item of interest in the budget, and that's homelessness. Mm-hmm. What's going on with that?
It's interesting because this time last year, the budget presentation was centered on increases and spending on homelessness. Spencer Cronk delivered the budget at LifeWorks, a shelter service provider. So the city essentially is maintaining the historic levels of spending on homeless services that they introduced in last year. That's $60 million for a variety of services. The city has kind of categorized it in three different ways: crisis mitigation, these sort of anti-displacement measures, which aim at preventing people from falling into homelessness in the first place. You know, the crisis mitigation is helping people once they're in that circumstance. And then what they're calling re-empowerment, which is once people are exiting homelessness, helping them to stabilize in their new housing status by maintaining jobs and healthcare and whatever it may be that's preventing them from having a more stabilized life. So yeah, that's $60 million. About $16.5 million is going to be focused on the anti-displacement efforts, which is going to be really important because as we've seen nationally, the pandemic and the economic fallout stemming from the pandemic is really pushing us, the nation, toward an eviction crisis. Something like 30% of households missed a housing payment last month in June. So the city is, I think, recognizing that and is really trying to invest or proposing investments in programs that could help stem off some of those evictions, which can cause homelessness.
Yeah, I've had that same thought. And the more I read about things, you know, with various unemployment programs ending, I have this fear that we're going to see a major wave of evictions coming up soon.
Yeah, it's going to be a problem locally, across the state and nationally. And as city council and city manager have kind of emphasized throughout the entire crisis, is in all cities and counties, they only have so much resources. They can't invest in the level of spending that is required to effectively deal with these crises. It really takes more state and federal intervention, although the city and county are trying to do what they can to help.
You say that's 16 million, 1-6 million?
Yeah, 16.5 of the 60 million. So the 60 million is kind of the umbrella of spending on homeless services. And that's a variety of programs that helps our shelters across town. That's going to go toward operating these, what they call permanent supportive housing units. As I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, the city has been buying motels and hotels across the city, which they plan to convert into these housing complexes for people experiencing homelessness, where they can have, you know, their own individual apartment and have access to healthcare and social services to get access to work and whatever other connections they need to kind of help, again, stabilize their lives. So the $60 million is going toward all of those kind of services, and the $16.5 million is specifically for programs aimed at preventing people from falling into homelessness.
Well, going forward here, what can we expect in the process? I mean, this is just the beginning of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this week, this Thursday, is the first public hearing the city council will have on the budget. That's going to be July 23rd. And basically what that is, an opportunity for stakeholders and individuals all across the city to tell the city council what's good about this budget proposal from the city manager and what's bad about it, what needs to improve, what should change. And council will take all of that feedback 23rd, and there's another hearing July 30th. They're having their own conversations, and they'll kind of distill all of that into budget amendments, which will be voted upon by the council, and if adopted, will shift around spending even further. So that's a big part of it. A decision on the tax rate, which is something that we didn't talk about, but that's another interesting part of the budget, because a state law that was passed in 2019 basically does not allow cities to increase the tax rate above 3.5%. But because we're in a local disaster, cities can kind of skirt past that tax rate election and go up to the previous maximum, which is 8%. However, the city of Austin's budget writers say they don't need to do that. They're just proposing a 3.5% tax rate increase. There's a variety of reasons for why they're doing that. That's another thing that the city council will approve. They may say, hey, we should bump this up so we can take in more revenue and put it into a reserve, because we don't know how long this recession is going to last, and we may want to start saving up more money to be able to help people for a longer period of time. So that's something that they'll vote on. It'll be in August, and then kind of in September is when the budget is officially adopted.
Let's switch topics here. We had elections this week. There were a couple races of particular interest. For me, I think that the DA race was perhaps the most interesting. What happened there?
Yeah, the district attorney race was really stunning, is really the word that I keep coming back to. Not just in the fact that Jose Garza defeated one-term incumbent Margaret Moore. There were various factors to point to. Jose Garza was really crushing Margaret in terms of fundraising. He had raised a lot more money than her. He had finished in first place in the March primary. It was a three-way primary, and he finished in first. So there were certainly clues to point to that show that Jose would win the runoff on Tuesday night. But the fact that he did it by basically 36% with over 43,000 vote margin, he just absolutely obliterated the incumbent, really sends a message to the courthouse establishment that obviously backs Margaret Moore. She has a long history in Travis County politics and in the courthouse specifically. But the voters, I think, really sent a message that Margaret Moore, who was elected as a reformer, you know, she came in and she has done some reforms on criminal justice issues, but it was not enough for voters. Clearly, they responded to Jose's campaign that Margaret had not done enough on these issues, let alone the mishandling of sexual assault cases that really tarnished her office that one of my colleagues, Sarah Marloff, has documented so thoroughly over the past few years. Those were issues that were just too detrimental, it seems, for Margaret to overcome. So Jose, yeah, I mean, he is a true reformer. Some of the things he's promising to do, he says he will never seek the death penalty in a case. He wants to end the war on drugs and prosecution of all low-level drug offenses. You know, he has the potential to be a national leader on the way that prosecutions are handled, especially with drug cases in Travis County. But the way that Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, the district attorney reform DA who was elected there recently, has become kind of a national figure of the way that a DA can be progressive on criminal justice issues, Jose Garza really has that opportunity as well.
And one other race, was it the county attorney, the other one that you were following so closely?
Yeah, that's right. The county attorney race, another Garza, Delia Garza, who is again a mayor pro tem on the city council. She also pulled off something of an upset in that race. She was running against Lori Iserloh, who is currently an assistant county attorney. She's worked in that office for around 10 years and has really like a 30-year career in legal issues in the law. And she was definitely the courthouse favorite along with Margaret. She was seen as kind of, you know, a step forward from David Escamilla, who's the current county attorney, who would be able to continue some of the progress on criminal justice issues that county attorney's office does, which they handle misdemeanor cases and including low-level drug arrests. So there's definitely opportunity for reform there. But yeah, Delia had pulled off that upset by about 10 points, I think the last time I looked, which was a little bit of a surprise. She finished in second in the March primary to Lori. She lost or came in second by about 6,000 votes. So for her to kind of flip that and end up winning by somewhere around 10,000 votes, I think really shows the focus of the electorate on criminal justice issues in light of the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Michael Ramos in Austin. Even though the county attorney doesn't really have anything to do with those cases, unlike the district attorney, there's just kind of been this craving in the community and the electorate for someone who is promising really transformative change to the criminal justice establishment. And both Garza's Delia and Jose are promising that more so than their opponents.
Well, you brought up Michael Ramos there, and I'm thinking about body cam and dashboard cam videos and what's going on with all that and with Manley these days. Did I just hear that the protesters, he's not turning over that video?
Yeah, so basically the chief announced a few weeks ago that there are investigations open into, I want to say five officers, it's just a handful, into incidents related to alleged misconduct that occurred in that first week or so of protests in Austin. That would have been in late May, early June. And obviously these officers were wearing body cams, presumably at least some of them were on. So there should be video footage from the officers' perspective to show what they were seeing, what they were hearing, and to either justify or condemn their actions, which again were in many cases shooting these lead pellet bags from shotguns at peaceful protesters, some of which ended up in the hospital with serious life-altering injuries. So it's very serious allegations against these officers. And on Monday, July 15th, Chief Manley announced that he is delaying the release of any video that was acquired from those incidents. The policy that regulates how the chief should release these body cam videos, he's allowed to request a delay within the first 60 days of an incident. He has to notify the public within 45 days of why he's releasing the videos. And in this case, he basically says that could, you know, disrupt ongoing investigations. This is kind of the standard answer that police chiefs all across the state give when the community is demanding release of body cam video. They fall back on this idea that to release it could taint a potential jury pool if criminal charges are pursued. or it could disrupt an investigation. It could prevent witnesses who could supply information from coming forward. There's very little interest from activists and in the community at large in this argument. There's a huge desire to see these videos. And there's been a lot of disappointments and frustration from activists in the community that Manley has chosen to withhold these videos because it's his decision entirely. But, you know, you kind of asked about Manley's standing. And from what I've seen thus far, this hasn't really changed things for him. City manager made it clear that he's staying on for now. That doesn't seem to have changed. There's conversations among city council members about what could the future of police leadership look like in Austin. But maybe it's not a single sworn chief. Maybe there's a chief and a civilian commissioner. Maybe there's five chiefs that are dispersed across the city and they kind of share power and authority. If that kind of reimagining is realized, then it could be a different conversation on what Brian Manley's role is with this department. But for the time being, he's staying on as chief and he seems to be pretty comfortable in that position.
Well, we're about out of time here. Really appreciate the update. A lot going on here. We need to get you on more often.
Yeah, let's not wait a few weeks next time. I'm sorry I wasn't able to join you before today, but yeah, I agree. Let's talk more.
Well, that's all for this evening. Stay tuned for theme music coming up next. Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe.